Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Tasha Chaparis. Joining me on the show this week is Dallas County reporter Naomi Martin.
Hi, Tasha.
Hi. And breaking news reporter Sarah Mervosh.
Hey, guys.
Today, we'll discuss the David and Goliath story of a real estate firm's lawsuit against an elderly woman with dementia. We'll also talk about the postponed execution for a father who killed his daughters and the latest complaints against the Dallas police chief. Let's get started.
Where's the law for justice? Where do these people get their training? They just don't give a damn. They don't care who you are. They are the only people that are important, the Henry Millers.
That was Ruth Sanders, a 93-year-old woman with Alzheimer's disease who has found herself embroiled in a legal battle with a Dallas real estate firm. But last weekend, that firm seems to have stepped back a bit. Sarah, what's going on with the lawsuit?
So this woman, Ruth Sanders, was sued by Henry S. Miller, which is a major real estate and brokerage firm, over a failed deal to put a 7-Eleven in place of her home, which is one of the last historic black houses in Uptown, which is a very affluent area of Dallas. We wrote about the story last week, and Henry S. Miller in the story basically said that they are entitled to their money, and they called her Alzheimer's defense convenient. Then over the weekend, the president showed up with cupcakes at her house and wanted to make a deal and have a settlement. So the president and this 93-year-old Ruth Sanders, her daughter, they came up with a deal and they're going to drop the suit, but it's not formal yet. They're hoping this week to formalize and create a binding settlement, but they basically came up with a non-binding settlement that they just negotiated in her living room.
So does she still have to release some kind of statement saying that they're not evil?
Yeah. So one of the conditions that the president wanted was, one, a front page story in the Dallas Morning News, which, you know, as the family's lawyer pointed out, they couldn't control. In fact, they ended up getting that because it was such big news. But another thing they wanted was for the family to say that the company wasn't evil and that they're not the bad guys they were being portrayed to be. And eventually the family did say they would release some sort of statement. And so I think we should still expect that to be coming possibly sometime this week. I don't know what exactly they're going to say, but whenever the settlement is formally and legally binding, they probably will come out and say something.
What prompted the change of heart? Like, was it just your story coming out initially? Or?
Well, our story came out on a Thursday, and then this didn't happen until Saturday. And so that was one of my questions as well. Like, you know, why, you know, when did they decide to do this and why? You know, in between those two things, a lot of the Dallas's black community came out and was pretty angered by this. You know, Henry S. Miller says that it was not racially driven at all, and that may be the case. But there's a certain sensitivity that has to happen in the situation because it is one of the last historically black homes in an area that has become gentrified and predominantly white. And so the Black Lawyers Association had taken up the case and people were speaking out, including someone who was associated with the original Henry S. Miller family. That the original owner has since died. And so there's sort of that original family was saying, this isn't right. Our family would never have done this. And so there was increasing pressure on the company to take care of it.
What was the reaction after the, I guess, quote unquote, cupcake story? Because it seemed that some people were saying that they didn't look better after that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was that sense that because they went in sort of half and half saying, we want to make this right, we want to do the right thing, but also we are legally entitled to this, and they were really difficult, and you know, it was sort of like, we're still right, but we want to do the right thing, and that I think didn't play well with some people. But overall, I think people gave credit where credit was due and said, you know, gave credit to Henry S. Miller for dropping the suit, but it's still, you know, people were grappling with what to really think of it. What did you guys think?
It was kind of like, I'm sorry, but, mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't an exact like, hey, we maybe took this too far. We apologize and then just let it go. It was, here's some cupcakes here. We will drop the suit. But we also come with more things that we're asking for, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite quotes in the story was the president saying, are we idiots for suing them? Yes. And then it was followed by, but. You know, and he explained his position. So,
right. I think one of the things that really struck me about this story is that, like you and I have spoken about this, about how most people end up in civil cases and they don't really know what to do in those moments. And we hear a lot about criminal cases and criminal courtrooms, but we don't know a whole lot about what goes on in civil courtrooms. And I would imagine that for this family, it was just like, what is going on? How did we end up in this situation?
That's a really good point, because you're more likely to end up in a civil litigation case than a criminal case, especially because you can be sued with, I mean, if you don't commit a crime, you're unlikely to be the defendant.
Right.
But you can be sued, you know, for anything. And so for this family, it was very much like the daughter said she had never been involved in any sort of litigation in her life. And she's a Stanford graduate. She's educated. And even for her, she was just totally in over her head. And so the lesson in this case, I think, is that it's really important to get good legal representation from the very beginning. You may not think you need it right away, but especially if you're an individual going up against a firm, it's very important to have a lawyer from the very beginning before you sign anything.
Well, I look forward to see what happens with that in the coming days and weeks. John Battaglia was convicted of the 2001 murders of his daughters. And after years on death row, he was scheduled to die last night, but got a last minute reprieve. Sarah, can you explain what exactly happened there?
John Battaglia was scheduled to die Wednesday. He'd been on death row for 14 years. He killed his daughters, Faith and Liberty. They were 9 and 6 in 2001. It was a grisly, grisly case. And anyone who lived in Dallas then will likely remember it, because he was on probation for domestic violence for his assaulting his ex-wife, and he knew he could go to jail. And so instead of, you know, going to dinner like he would usually do with his daughters on his nightly custody visit, he took them to his Deep Ellum loft and shot them while he was on the phone with their mother. And their mother heard her daughters screaming for their life, saying, "No, Daddy, don't do it, please. Why do you want Mommy to have to, or why do you want Daddy to have to go to jail?" And so it was just really disturbing. And then he went to a Deep Ellum tattoo parlor to get tattoos in memory of his daughters afterward, two roses in memory of his daughters. And then he also left a voicemail that night on his daughter's answering machine saying, "You know, I love you, my little babies. You know, I hope you're resting in a different place." And so, you know, everyone's just sort of struggling to make sense of this horrific crime. And he was scheduled to die last night. He was convicted and sentenced to death. But he did get a last minute reprieve because they're saying that his lawyer needs more time to pursue claims that he's mentally incompetent because of mental health issues.
Has he ever shown any remorse?
Well, I'm not sure if he's ever shown it to anyone, but I did interview him 2 years ago. And in that clip, he did not show much remorse. We can hear a little bit from him now.
I mean, do you feel like you were killing them to get back at your
wife? I don't feel like I killed.
You what?
I don't feel like I killed.
So why did you...
I do not know why. If you read what I wrote, you will find out that I am a little bit in the blank about what happened.
So you can hear me sort of struggling to understand in that conversation, like, you know, what's going on? Why did you do this? And he doesn't deny doing it in the interview, but he doesn't explain anything at all. He just says, you know, I don't know what happened. And he says he's not worried about his daughters because, you know, he keeps photos of them in his prison cell and he's just not worried about, you know, death. He says, we're all here. We're all gone at the same time. I'm not worried about it.
Have you talked at all to the ex-wife?
Well, she didn't want to comment for stories that I've written. I did briefly talk to her, but off the record, I think it's just very hard on her. I did talk to John Battaglia's daughter from a previous marriage. She's in her late 20s or maybe early 30s now. And she really struggles with this because these were her half siblings. And she obviously is horrified and so sad for them and mad at her dad. But then at the same time, he's still her dad, and so she's really struggling with how to feel about his impending execution.
Does she want him to be put to death, or has she said at all what her position is on that?
Well, I haven't talked to her in a little while, but last time I talked to her, she was struggling with it. I think that I got the impression that, no, she doesn't want him to be put to death, but she just doesn't know how to feel. She's like, well, on the one hand, you know, he's my dad, and you know, he's going to get a needle put in his arm by lethal injection, but I can't even really, like, give him a hug before that happens. That seems, you know, not fair. So she's struggling because she's both the victim and the defendant's family.
So what happens next? What if he is found to be, mentally ill for whatever reason.
Well, that would be a long road, because his trial attorneys at the very beginning argued that he had bipolar disorder. And so this was a defense from the very beginning, and the jury did not believe that it was reason to not convict him or to give him a lesser sentence. And so it would have to be, he'd have to argue that he not only was that, you know, incorrect, but that he doesn't deserve to be executed because of an insanity claim. And if he wasn't found insane at the trial, that's a hard thing to overcome.
Right.
But he could, I mean, that's always possible, but it would just be a very long road. So now the case is going back to the trial court in Dallas for the attorneys to argue in state court over the mental competency issue. And the judge there would have to rule on whether or not he's mentally competent.
And with the insanity issue, I mean, he could be mentally ill, but that doesn't mean he didn't understand that what he did was wrong and illegal. And it seems like he recognizes at least that he had a part in their death, right? I mean, his reaction was odd, so it's kind of weird to figure out, okay, what is this man really thinking?
Well, exactly. I mean, that was sort of my impression walking out of the interview, was like, I have no idea what he thinks. But I mean, the appeals court that issued the last minute stay of execution didn't make any ruling on whether or not he is insane, but they just said, you know, he has exhibited symptoms of mental illness and delusions. He's like accused his own attorneys of trying to conspire to help him get executed. And he blames everyone and anyone for what happened to him. You know, the trial court, the DA, the Dallas Morning News, his attorneys. And so there is certainly this delusion of conspiracy around him. But you're right in that he may be mentally ill, but that doesn't necessarily qualify to say that he doesn't deserve the death penalty, which he's been assigned by a jury.
Right. Well, it seems like it'll be a much longer wait than it's already been, that 14 years. So,
yeah, no date has been set yet. So we'll have to wait and stay tuned.
A written statement to the mayor, all 14 city council members, the city manager and the assistant city manager over public safety, stating what our concerns were, in that we could no longer support Chief Brown as a chief of police. We haven't changed that statement. We haven't withdrawn it. It was not made on personal bias toward the chief. We looked at a collective history of what he's done over the years.
That was Lieutenant Thomas Glover, president of the Black Police Association. The association has come out against Dallas Police Chief David Brown, saying that they don't believe he is fit to lead the department anymore. It comes in light of a violent crime increase of 23% this year over last year, and also a whopping 75% increase in murders, which has been alarming to some folks in the community. And so to combat that, Brown has announced a plan to move officers to later shifts and different task forces. And some of those officers include detectives who investigate family violence cases, drug cases, and track sex offenders in the city. But this time seems a little bit different than the last time that a police association has tried to put Brown's job on the line. So can you speak a little bit about that, Naomi? What's different this time?
Sure. So a lot seems similar, and a lot seems a little different. So basically, last time there seemed to be sort of more of a covert effort with two of the city council members supposedly going to, you know, behind closed doors to have a meeting with the city manager, supposedly asking for Brown to retire. This time, it seems more like it's being driven by the associations. And And last time, the Dallas Police Association, which is the largest group and not really a racial group, but historically has been more white than the others, was leading the charge. This time around, it's actually the Black Police Association. And Chief Brown is a black chief. He was a longtime member of that association. So it does kind of turn the tables, because the Black Police Association, a few months ago when he was under fire, was the only group, was one of the more vocal groups supporting him. So now he's got them calling for his resignation, and it's created a rift among some of the Black Police Association members who still do support Chief Brown. Some of the former presidents had a press conference yesterday about it, saying that they believe a lot of the current members still do support Chief Brown, and that the new president who took office within the last few months is sort of going rogue. But it's really unclear how the Black Police Association feels. They have hundreds of members, and from what we've heard, no one seems to have done a very good survey of them.
Yeah, they didn't survey them. They've just been fielding phone calls and hearing complaints, but no official survey.
And so it's really unclear, and they're saying, you know, a lot of the associations are saying that the violent crime spike is what preceded them trying to oust Chief Brown, that his policies are making the community unsafe. But it's kind of unclear whether that's actually true, because violent crime has been going up now for over a year. And so it seems like a weird time now of all times to you know, get this high point. I mean, what do you think is driving this, Tasha?
Well, I think that a lot of it is confusion. You know, yesterday, several of the police associations, it is worth noting that this is one of the first times, the few times that all four police associations have come together, and the major police associations in the city have come together and actually had meetings and are somewhat on the same page. There's varying levels of how they feel about whether Brown should remain in his job. Aside from the Black Police Association, none of the others have explicitly said we want him gone. And the Black Police Association hasn't even said how they want him gone, whether they want him fired, whether they'd like to see him resign or just retire. It's kind of semantics. But a lot of it just seems to be about the communication problems within the department. It doesn't seem that Chief Brown was very clear about what his plan was before actually saying that there would be changes. And so there's been a lot of confusion. Also, one of the major criticisms is the movement of investigators from those roles onto patrolling the streets. So, you know, you're looking at cases that might possibly not be getting as long of a look or strong of a look as they might ordinarily get. So that seems to be part of it.
Right. And one of the issues that I think has some validity is that the murders being so far up, a lot of them have to do with drugs, but right. Then some of the narcotics detectives are getting moved to off their assignments, and so it kind of seems to go against that goal of cutting down on those drug related crimes.
It's also a different tune from what they did a few years ago. I mean, beefing up the family violence unit, that was a major thing that the police department did to try to combat family violence, which at the time they said that were a lot of murders were family violence.
And they're saying that now too.
Right.
They are also saying that a lot of the murders are related to domestic violence.
And beyond the murders themselves, you know, because murder is perhaps a little bit less preventable, but the other cases like the robberies and the aggravated assaults, a large portion of the aggravated assaults that we're seeing this year are family violence. And Sarah, I mean, you've covered the issue of domestic violence a lot. What do you see in terms of that issue and having a larger unit that would be able to investigate those cases?
Yeah, one of the major benefits of having a larger unit to investigate family violence cases is being able to follow up with victims to make them realize that they're not alone. So a lot of these things are repeat offenders. So you've got it starts out as like a low level assault where they're just like hitting the person, and then they threaten them with a knife or a gun or actually slash them or shoot them, which would be aggravated assault. And so if you have police doing home visits where they actually go and try to find these victims and talk to them and remind them of the resources, where the word in the community sort of spreads that the police aren't giving up on family violence cases, it sends a message to the offenders, and it also lets victims know that they can get out. And so it in theory, the hope is that it will prevent the more severe aggravated assaults and murders.
Right. And also, there's been discussion about how this has affected the unit that tracks sex offenders in the city as well. Some of those have been moved off onto task forces. The flip side of this, though, is that Chief Brown has rolled back a little bit on his original plan, although it's unclear what the change is since Monday when he announced that 600 officers would be moved from their current assignments onto different assignments. We also potentially will have state troopers patrolling the streets of Dallas, which is a bit unusual, but that comes after Governor Greg Abbott read about the increase in crime and offered the DPS help. So,
well, is there what is the reason or is there any explanation for why the crime has increased so much? It's as a regular citizen, it seems a little bit scary.
So crime goes up and down, and a lot of people like study it, but there's never really been like any definitive reason as to why. Chief Brown did talk about the weather being a factor, and we actually looked at some of the data in our office, you know, related to the average temperatures and related to the crime over the past several years. And we actually did see that it does go up and down, kind of similar to
when it's hotter, that it's
that there's more crime.
Yes.
And so we never had that like cold snap this past winter where, you know, crime really dips down a lot. And we're not sure that that's the only thing at play. There's probably a lot of factors that go into this, and obviously poverty and socioeconomic factors that are really hard to sort of measure related to crime have a lot to do with it. But we did see that, and Chief Brown mentioned that on Monday, so we did want to sort of check into that and see whether there was any, whether we could confirm or deny any of that. And it seemed like it might actually be true.
But if Chief Brown had the support of the associations, I don't think that, you know, the weather affecting crime would be enough for calling for his ouster. So can you remind people about his sort of tangled history in the controversy? I mean, he's been pretty controversial from when he first took office.
Right. So the associations have long complained that he's like retaliatory and vengeful distrustful of a lot of the officers, rank and file officers, very quick to move people around if he isn't happy, or give them unfavorable shifts or assignments. Chief Brown has always denied that and said that he tries to be as fair as possible, and that, you know, he can't please everyone, and he wants to hold officers accountable, and they don't like that. So that's kind of been a longstanding conflict in the department. And I should mention too that is a pretty common tension between the chief and officers in every city, most cities that I've covered, anyways. But here they did have a very popular chief before Chief Brown, which was David Kunkel, and apparently, from what I've heard, he had a better working relationship with a lot of the officers and a lot of the officer groups. So I think that, in contrast to David Brown, is probably, you know, makes Chief Brown seem worse than Kunkel in a lot of the officers' views.
Part of it too seems that Chief Brown is still appears to be fairly popular among the community at large. He goes to a lot of events.
He tweets.
People follow him. He's still relatively popular among city council members. The mayor is supportive. The city manager, who is his boss, continues to be supportive. So there seems to be a bit of that division of how people in the department see him and how the community at large sees him.
Well, that's a good point, though, and like which is more important for the city overall. I mean, I don't know the answer to that, but it seems like, you know, it's important that the city likes him and that he's protecting the citizens of Dallas. On the other hand, if his own people don't like working for him, that has ripple effects that we can't even predict.
The last thing that any mayor or city official wants is to be another Ferguson or Baltimore with, you know, large scale unrest about police, you know, killings or shootings. So I think that they do take his community relations. You know, he grew up in Oak Cliff. He's been in Dallas his whole life. He's very homegrown, and he has a lot of community ties. And I think that they're not going to just throw that away because the associations are unhappy. I think they take that very seriously. And he talks a lot about that, too. He talks all the time at city council about his efforts to reduce officer use of force and keep tensions with the community as low as possible.
All right. Thank you, Naomi. It will be interesting to continue following this in the coming days and weeks and see what the reaction is as we keep following this story. Thank you again today to my co-hosts Sarah Mervosh and Naomi Martin. Remember, our show comes out every Thursday, so be sure to join us again next week. We're on iTunes, so subscribe to our channel, tweet us at Texas Crime Cast, and remember to find more on all of our stories today and continuing coverage on dallasnews.com. And thanks to our producer, Tommy Noel, I'm Tasha Chaparis, and also Mike Hashimoto is off this week, so you'll just have to imagine what he might say in hashing it out.